Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the festival's 2013 season, From Bach. This season, Music at Menlo celebrates Johann Sebastian Bach, the composer universally recognized as the greatest in Western music history. To the ears of many modern listeners, the canon begins with Bach, and in the 2.5 centuries since Bach's death, arguably every major musical innovation has borne his influence. Bach's legacy endures, whether in the craftsmanship of composers from Haydn to Mozart to Mendelssohn, in the sonic magnitude of Brahms, Bartok, and Shostakovich, and even in the sensual allure of Debussy, Richard Strauss, and George Gershwin. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts. Bach is often considered the patriarch of a Germanic tradition, a lineage fulfilled by Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, and Brahms. Echoes of his music's structural rigor are encountered in the thematic complexity and formal perfection of these later classical and romantic era composers. But equally vibrant in Bach's language are the elegance, color, and romance that characterize the music of France more than a century later. The bewitching spirit of Bach's French suites surfaces in Saint-Saëns' seductive Fantasy and Debussy's ethereal Sonata for flute, viola, and harp. César Franck's powerful piano quintet presents a climactic synthesis of French color and German romanticism.
Concert Program 6, French Connections, begins with Johann Sebastian Bach's French Suite No. 5 in G major. Bach composed the 6 French suites for solo keyboard between the years 1722 to 1725. The suites only became known as the French suites after Bach's lifetime, primarily to distinguish them from the English suites, an earlier set of 6 suites, and likewise titled posthumously. Johann Nikolaus Forkel explained in his 1802 biography of Bach, quote, "One usually calls them the French suites because they are written in the French manner," end quote. Now, from a scholarly perspective, this claim isn't quite true. Actually, the French suites more closely reflect Italian styles of the day. But their particular color, texture, and elegance might indeed place them, to the ear of a modern listener, in the company of works by such later French composers as Gabriel Fauré, Claude Debussy, and others. The French and English suites have traditionally been considered companion sets. Comparatively, the French suites are less contrapuntally complex, leaning instead towards flowing cantabile melodic lines. Bach is known to have used his keyboard music as a teaching tool for his composition students. One student left an account of Bach's pedagogical method, describing a progression from the French and English suites and culminating in the well-tempered clavier. In other words, the elegance and transparency of the French suites might have been designed to serve as a kind of 101-level course in composition, saving the most intricate counterpoint for the preludes and fugues of the well-tempered. It's also known that Bach composed the first 5 French suites as a wedding gift to his second wife, Anna Magdalena Bach, which is equally likely to have something to do with their tender charm. Like numerous other important instrumental works, including the cello suites, the solo violin partitas, the orchestral suites, the French suites are multi-movement works based on traditional dance forms. Forgoing a prelude, the suites each begin with an allemande, one of the most popular dance forms of the Baroque period. The counterpoint is simple, the texture transparent, and the melody flowing and mellifluous. Despite using French titles, The suite's various dance forms are associated with different cultures, giving the suite something of an international dimension. And, equally noteworthy, a distinct variety of character from one movement to the next. Following the Allemande, which is a German dance, comes the more spirited Courante, derived from the Italian Corrente, a 17th century courtship dance. The Saraband comes from the Spanish Zarabanda, a dance form originating in the 16th century. Bach retains little of the Zarabanda's Spanish flair, however. He instead adapts the Saraband's rhythmic profile to fit the music's elegant, almost regal carriage. Three French dance forms follow: the gavotte, a lively duple meter court dance, the bourrée, also a court dance, but of a different character, and the lure, a form whose origins are unclear, but which developed in the 18th century as a slow, noble dance movement. The suite concludes with a gigue, or a jig, an upbeat English folk dance. With the defeat of France in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, came a marked shift in Europe's balance of power. The Second French Empire, under the reign of Napoleon III, collapsed. The war brought about a newly unified Germany, which would claim the French territory of Alsace-Lorraine until the end of the First World War. This course of events inspired deep nationalist sentiment throughout France, a spirit that would be reflected as much in the country's musical activity as in other cultural spheres. In 1871, 1 year after France's military defeat, the Société Nationale de Musique was formed. 3 years later, the French conductor and violinist Édouard Colonne founded the Concert de l'Association Artistique. For several decades leading to this point, lyric opera had dominated France's cultural life. Now, these fledgling organizations spurred a flurry of instrumental composition, laying the foundation for a strong tradition of French chamber music towards the turn of the 20th century. This charge was led by some of France's most prominent composers, including Ernest Chausson, César Franck, and Camille Saint-Saëns. Saint-Saëns was one of his country's most highly regarded musical figures over the latter half of the 19th century. A child prodigy who attracted considerable attention in his youth, he continued to be regarded in his maturity as an excellent technician in all parts of his craft. In addition to being a prolific composer in every prevalent genre of French music during his time, he was also a gifted pianist and organist, and was often compared during his lifetime to Mozart. Saint-Saëns composed his Opus 124 Fantasy for violin and harp in 1907. Throughout the 1890s, his compositional language had been moving further and further in the direction of lighter, more delicate textures.
Well, Saint-Saëns, towards the end of his life, was thinking that maybe the piano was a bit too heavy for the chamber music he was envisioning.
Harpist Bridget Kibbe.
And that's why he turned to the harp as collaborator to the violin. And I think this piece is very virtuosic for the violin. The harp does have a big solo in the middle, but I think that what I love about this is that the harp really collaborates with the violinist.
The Fantasy is an episodic, single-movement work, comprising wildly contrasting sections. As the work begins, the violin assumes melodic primacy above a thoughtful accompaniment in the harp. The tempo accelerates, and the violin offers an impassioned melody against restless arpeggios and chords in the harp. The music grows more fervent, with rhapsodic runs and fortissimo double stops in the violin, met by the harp with equal fervor. The violin follows this with playful runs, punctuated by lightly plucked chords in the harp. Saint-Saëns presents a new sonority, as the violin recedes to the background with low, sustained notes, coloring fanciful runs in the harp.
And what's fun for me is also the middle section is a bit of a gypsy section where the harp almost acts like a pluck string or a balalaika or a guitar accompanying the violin as he or she rocks out. It is a fantasy, and what makes this piece special to me is I envision there are many different sections that kind of meander into one another. And I imagine this piece being much like walking into a home where each room is decorated in a completely different way and you're taking a walk through all of the rooms. And so as a listener, I think you're going to enjoy hearing a lot of different thematic material that comes through this fantasy that's like a dream world.
The French composer Claude Debussy is universally regarded as one of the most influential musical voices of the 20th century. To the ears of many music lovers, his landmark work of 1894, Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, represents the beginning of a new era in music. The composer and conductor Pierre Boulez wrote that with this work, quote, "the art of music began to beat with a new pulse," end quote. Debussy's unique approach to harmony, rhythm, and orchestration was driven as much by a conscious resistance to the prevailing German musical language of composer Richard Wagner as it was by the instinctive desire to express himself in an original way. This approach yielded a distinctly French musical voice, as distinguishable by its color and inflection from the German idiom as the actual spoken languages are different. The musical language cultivated by Debussy became known as Impressionism, a term borrowed from the visual arts, and specifically the work of Claude Monet. As applied to the music of Debussy, the term describes a rich palette of harmonic colors and instrumental timbres, often treated in ways contrary to the dictates of classical tradition. To give you an example, where a composer of the German Romantic tradition might have used frequent changes in harmony to build dramatic tension. Debussy's music often demonstrates a penchant for luxuriating in one harmony for a prolonged period of time. Musicologist Jan Passler has interpreted such impressionist devices as, quote, an attempt to explore the fleeting moments and the mystery of life, end quote. Even during his days as a student at the Paris Conservatory, when presenting sketches in a class taught by the composer César Franck, Debussy was challenged by Franck to modulate to a new key. Debussy replied, "Why should I modulate when I am perfectly happy in the tonality I am in?" Debussy's Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp, composed in 1916, represents one of the composer's last completed works. It was one of a projected set of six sonatas for various instruments, only three of which Debussy saw to fruition before succumbing to the cancer that had afflicted him for several years. In addition to this work, Debussy also completed the Cello Sonata in 1915 and the Violin Sonata in 1917.
Well, we're so thankful to have the Debussy trio.
Harpist Bridget Kibbe.
It is one of the last pieces that Debussy ever wrote. And so he's already kind of established himself as, you know, a modern composer, as taking music to new directions. And I think the way he does that on the harp is incredible. And the way he pairs the harp with these instruments, it's actually an instrumentation that no one had ever seen before, flute, viola, and harp. It makes for a very transparent, translucent texture. So the way he blends the flute and viola together creates this almost completely new instrument, creating this new color that's never before been heard. And when you add the harp, it's really quite an incredible texture. So there are many times in the piece where he has a very elusive melody that starts, like, for example, the opening few bars of the Debussy trio, you have this kind of hanging line in the flute, and you don't know where the harmony is. As a listener, you don't quite know where it's going. It's very elusive. You don't know the reference point of what does this line mean. And it's not until, you know, the viola and the harp come together later in the piece that you finally get the feeling like that was one big introduction that's leading us into this kind of melancholy feeling.
The tempo quickens and the sonority, though still ethereal and shaded in pastel hues, expands. The viola and harp provide a nuanced accompanimental texture as a backdrop to the flute melody. The character of this music is elusive. Though it appears to be joyful, the ensemble's gossamer timbre gives it a wistful air.
Something else you hear is the flute and viola creating a duo voice, creating this unison between the two instruments that's really lovely. And then the harp creates kind of an undulating motor underneath a lot of the time.
Debussy takes full advantage of the elasticity of the ensemble's sound, shifting each instrument between background and foreground, combining them in different registers, to conjure a variety of textures throughout the work. For instance, in this passage, marked vif et joyeux, bright and cheerful, the viola comes to the fore, colored by the flute.
What makes this piece very special is this mysterious, elusive, transparent texture that he creates. And when Debussy was writing this piece, he was actually taking morphine for the cancer that he was battling. And as a result, his eyesight was a little bit diminished. And so they think that there was an actual haze to what he was seeing. And you almost hear that haze in the texture of his harp writing.
In his drive to assert the identity of French music against the growing wave of German influence, especially while Europe was in the throes of the First World War, Debussy looked to the music of two of France's great Baroque composers, François Couperin and Jean-Philippe Rameau, as models of elegance and textural clarity. Where is French music, he asked? Where are the old harpsichordists who had so much true music? They had the secret of gracefulness and emotion without epilepsy, which we have negated like ungrateful children. The second movement of the sonata for flute, viola, and harp, cast in the form of a minuet, strongly evokes the secret of gracefulness and emotion that Debussy sought in the music of the past. Debussy marks the melody to be played piano, dolce, semplice, soft, sweet, and simple.
Debussy describes the opening as being, he imagines, a pile of leaves, and the wind stirs just the top bit of the leaves on the top of that pile, circles them around, and then sets them back down. So when you hear the beginning of the second movement, there's this element of mystery.
A faster middle section in 4/4 time and marked poco più animato, slightly more animated, suggests the Far Eastern influence on French art and culture in the early 20th century.
In the second movement, the harp is this incredible transparent texture that you would imagine from the harp in creating these beautiful arpeggios that almost sound like glissandos. And I think it's really a chance for audience members to encounter, you know, the mysterious element of the harp. ¶¶ I think what I like about this piece, it's very special, is that the harp wears so many hats. The role of the harp is so unique and varied throughout the three movements. The last movement, the harp is almost percussionist in creating this incredibly exciting motor underneath this really exciting rhythm and line that the flute and viola pass back and forth. What's nice about following last year's season with this program is the fact that we really delved into, you know, the first piece written for the concert harp as we know it, which was Debussy Danse. And I think the harp really enjoyed an incredible season during this time of French culture because composers were just fascinated by its wide color palette. So it's not surprising when you have these French composers like Saint-Saëns, Debussy, and Ternier, who was a harpist himself, that every time they change harmony in a piece of music, they expect the performer to change the color that they use to perform that harmony. And the harp is a perfect instrument to change color. It's capable of creating so many different timbres throughout one line.
Debussy's Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp was premiered in 1917 by the French harpist Pierre Jamet. Debussy's Sonata, one of the earliest major works in the harp repertoire, and still to this day one of the most famous pieces in the harp literature, so enthralled Jamet that he right away established a new chamber ensemble, the Instrumental Quintet of Paris, comprising a flautist, violinist, violist, cellist, and himself. The express purpose of this new quintet was to expand the chamber music repertoire for harp through further commissions. In 1929, Jamet commissioned composer and fellow harpist Marcel Tournier to write his suite for flute, harp, and strings, Opus 34.
And Tournier is known for being one of those composers that writes a lot of our repertoire, kind of like the well-tempered clavier of Bach. He writes a lot of repertoire that teaches harpists how to play idiomatically on the instrument.
Harpist Bridget Kibbe.
And so this piece is just very satisfying in the hands to play. And I think what's lovely about it is, again, these textures. He's really creating a bunch of images. He's creating these sketches, a piece of night, of dusk. And I think, you know, each of these images are quite unmistakable when you hear the patterns, the colors that he chooses for each movement.
Tournier's Opus 34 suite is set in four movements. In true Impressionist fashion, Tournier titles the first movement Soir, or Evening. The subsequent three movements each have a distinct character, but all further demonstrate the Impressionist language, as moreover defined by the irresistible timbre of Tournier's ensemble. The second movement is simply titled Danse. Tournier identifies the heartfelt third movement as a lied, or song. The suite concludes with a mirthful finale, which the composer titles Fête.
there's two things that makes Trunier a very sensitive composer and aware of what is idiomatic on the harp. And the first thing is he understands the formation of the hands, being a harpist himself. In fact, most people don't realize we don't use our pinkies when we play. So we have the access to four fingers in each hand. And so he writes these beautiful arpeggios and figurations where you're kind of crossing hand over hand, which is effortless and easy for us and something we learn to do that really showcases the range, the broad pitch range of the harp through these lovely arpeggios. The other thing he does is he orchestrates beautifully, and every single note that the harp plays, especially in the tenor range, which is our beautiful center, kind of the warmest part of the harp, he uses the harp to create kind of this gooey, warm inner texture to support the flute and the strings. And so you find the harp oftentimes in some of these more sensitive movements, I think, taking the role of cello or the tenor voice. And then, of course, in more the dance-like movements, the harp is, you know, brighter and kind of being featured more as a soloist.
To hear more of my conversation with Bridget Kibbe and other Audio Notes outtakes, visit us online at www.musicatmenlo.org/multimedia/audio notes.
The program concludes with the Opus 7 Piano Quintet by the French romantic composer César Franck.
The French composer and organist César Franck represents an important dimension of France's musical climate in the latter half of the 19th century. In addition to his role during this period, in a renaissance of sorts of French instrumental composition, Franck was one of his generation's great musical pedagogues, cherished and revered by his students at the Paris Conservatoire. Franck taught organ at the Conservatoire, but owing to his greater emphasis on counterpoint and improvisation than on keyboard technique, he was widely regarded as the Academy's premier composition professor. Franck guided a generation of French composers wrestling with the profound impact of Richard Wagner on Europe's musical landscape. Wagner's revolutionary philosophies on art and music in the late 19th century seduced many young composers who strove to emulate his stylistic innovations. Others, such as Debussy, developed a strong ambivalence towards Wagner and regarded him as a symbol of the prevailing German aesthetic, a backdrop against which to define their own language. Franck's fascination with Wagner is evident in his own au courant approach to harmony and form. But rather than reverently mimicking Wagner, Franck absorbed that influence and integrated it with the fundamental values of the classical era to ultimately serve his own musical vision. Scholars John Trevitt and Joël-Marie Fauquet have noted in Franck's late chamber works, quote, a balance between his inherent emotionalism and his preoccupation with counterpoint and classical forms, a double allegiance to the Viennese tradition on the one hand and to Liszt and Wagner on the other, end quote. The result of this duality is a compelling and individual voice that pointed French music towards the 20th century.
Franck completed his piano quintet in F minor in 1879. The work is striking for its intense expressive passion. Some have even been offended by the work's overwhelming pathos. Following the quintet's premiere in 1880, with Franck's close friend Camille Saint-Saëns at the piano, Franck joined Saint-Saëns on stage and asked him to accept the original manuscript as a token of his gratitude. Saint-Saëns, to whom Franck had dedicated the quintet, expressed his displeasure with the work by refusing the manuscript and walking off stage. Another listener whose favor the piano quintet failed to win was Franck's wife, who suspected that its visceral power could have only been inspired by amorous feelings for another woman.
Despite Saint-Saëns' reservations, the piano quintet is an expertly wrought work. It is cast in cyclic form, a compositional device particularly associated with Franck, in which thematic material from one movement resurfaces in later movements. This technique serves to unify the separate movements of a piece as an organic whole. The disparate contexts in which one musical idea appears, moreover, infuse it with multiple layers of meaning. Cyclic form is closely related to Wagner's use of leitmotifs and Liszt's principle of thematic transformation. The way in which Franck uses cyclic form also evokes Beethoven's penchant for dramatically recalling earlier themes at climactic points in his music.
In the first movement's introductory measures, the piano answers the string's powerful declamation with a thoughtful, lilting soliloquy. The plot thickens as the movement's slow introduction yields to the main allegro section. Into the allegro, Franck transforms the piano's earlier soliloquy into the movement's second theme. Franck marks the second movement, lento con molto sentimento. Though markedly less extroverted, the music loses nothing of the first movement's fervor. In the midst of these melancholic sighs, the lilting piano soliloquy from the first movement reappears. Following a quietly frenzied introduction, the finale's impassioned first theme sweeps in above a diabolical triplet accompaniment in the piano. The understated second theme recalls the melancholy of the slow movement. Franck develops each of these themes throughout this dramatic sonata form finale, restlessly expanding its emotive breadth. Before the work's fiery conclusion, Franck looks wistfully back once more to the quintet's cyclical theme. The first violin marked pianissimo, dolcissimo, molto espressivo, longingly reprises the first movement's piano soliloquy.
Audio notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional narration is provided by Andrew Goldstein. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. J.S. Bach Sonata for Violin and Harpsichord in C Minor, performed by Elizabeth Walfish and Paul Nicholson. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's G Major Piano Trio and Johannes Brahms's C Minor Piano Trio, Opus 101, performed by the Florestan Trio, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Paul Schoenfield's Café Music, performed by Lev Poliakin, Charles Bernard, and Francis Renzi, appears courtesy of Innova Records. Bach's Fifth French Suite, performed by Wilhelm Kempf, appears courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Camille Saint-Saëns' Fantasy, performed by the Banff Camerata, appears courtesy of Summit Records Incorporated. Claude Debussy's Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp, performed by Ransom Wilson, Paul Neubauer, and Heidi Leivalder, and César Franck's Piano Quintet, performed by Angela Hewitt, Annika Vafian, Jennifer Frauci, Paul Neubauer, and Daniel Mueller-Schott, appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Marcel Tournier's Opus 34 Suite is performed by the Linos Harfen Quintet, and appears courtesy of Hensler Classic. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.